Like, I'm going to keep it real. Sometimes when I see these girls, I'm like, but you're 14. I want to say
boys.
To them,
and the boys.
But I want to tell them, don't do it.
Yeah, no, same.
Don't do it.
Like
you're
just,
young.
Sometimes I just have a word at the tip of my mouth.
I'm like you know what? Yeah. One thing I struggle with is, you know, they come in, and I'm not saying that it's not true. I'm not saying that, oh, I'm so in love. I'm going to marry this girl.
It's not true.
Eh? Life hasn't come yet for you.
And then that child, someone would say they're mature enough to share information about decisions they're making about something that's happened.
According
to
Gilly competent.
Yeah. So it's a tricky one.
Yeah.
So maybe we would say that is why it's important for parents to start the advocacy from
100%.
So, sexual health. I want us to touch on sexual health. How, as a nurse, how, and this is so, I've spoken about it on the Parent Ambassador platform on Instagram, and I've had conversations with parents about it. Sexual health, how do we touch on sexual health with our children? Many nurses have found out that children as young as primary school age are beginning to show signs of emotional distress, often linked to family issues, social media use, and academic pressures. Today, I'm so excited as we have an amazing nurse on our show called Yvette. Yvette is a nurse with an amazing platform called ArxNurse. ArxNurse is dedicated to providing resources for nurses and healthcare professionals, irrespective of where they are in their career. Tips on how to progress seeking out their roles, utilizing their skills, and exploring non-beside roles via IGTV, Reels, IG, Post, and also a great podcast. Yvette has been a nurse for 8 years, kickstarting her career in a neonatal nursing, leaving her speciality as a junior sister to pursue her passion in public health nursing, taking a particular interest in school nursing. Yvette went on to completing her specialist community public health nursing course, becoming a specialist school nurse, working in the pupil referral unit and home educated population. She has now embarked on a new journey, working with the local authority, contributing to the rehabilitation of young people within the Youth Justice Service as a youth justice nurse. Hello.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm excited. I'm excited for our conversation that we're going to have today.
I hope so.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm really, really happy that you honoured this invitation.
Amazing platform, of course. Why would I not say yes?
Because the thing is, I think one thing when I thought of nursing and I thought of you is I want parents and families to be able to see nurses beyond the ward, to see nurses beyond being a staff nurse. I don't want to say just, but the only remit of nurses is just being on the ward in St. Thomas or Guy's.
Yeah.
Or just, you know.
Yeah, just wearing trousers and a
tunic. You know, there are more options.
Yeah.
And they deal with children in so many different types of ways. And we're going to be speaking about some of those ways today.
Yeah.
So the first question I'm going to ask you is, with your experience and your knowledge, what is classified as a healthy child?
Healthy child. I'm not even going to say that's subjective because I don't think it is. It's so easy to say that, you know, some things are subjective and it depends on the circumstances, culture, etc. But actually, no, there is a staple. And I think a healthy child essentially needs should be met, emotionally, physically, mentally. And essentially also that can then go on to various areas of, like, you know, having the right nutrition, having adequate parenting. But I'm going to actually read my iPad because, you know what, one thing about me, I'm going to bring my notes. And essentially, when I was thinking about a healthy child from my perspective, this is my definition. So guys, don't come for me. But anyway, I would say that a healthy child essentially is someone who is growing both physically and mentally, eating nutritious food, but also staying active, having enough sleep. But also then those things will contribute to a young person, a child as well, let's say, because they will eventually grow into a young person. But essentially that contributes them to be able to play, learn, socialize effectively, but also reach their normal developmental milestones at the right time. But also I feel like a healthy child essentially feels loved, you know, they feel supported, and essentially at that young age that's only going to be from their families and caregivers. Yes, we can go on to the educational system, but as a fundamental, that is their family and caregivers.
I really like that definition because it goes beyond health.
Yeah.
Physical health.
Yeah.
I think sometimes when we're talking about a healthy child, we speak about a child that's had all their injections.
Yeah.
Goes to their checkups, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. their first speech and language consultation is yeah. take, their height, their weight.
Yeah.
But a healthy child, as you said, is about nutrition.
Yeah.
It's about mental health. It's about mm-hmm. neglect. Are those child's needs being met?
Exactly.
So I love that definition. I think that should be the new one.
Yeah. Pay me for it though.
And again, it proves that the small things matter.
Yeah.
Or what we think actually
yeah.
are the small things.
The mundane things.
The mundane things, yeah. the 10 minutes of special time
yeah.
can increase your child's emotional health.
Of course. And their security as well.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if we can go on for a day, but attachment theories as well.
Yep.
You know, I don't want to divert, but those are the things that contribute into how they become a young person,
yeah.
then become an adult. And so if you're even looking at different legislations, we can look at, I don't know, Every Child Matters.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at the outcomes that they have, the right to be healthy, but then essentially you need to look at the last one. I think it's the right to contribute mm. to society. And actually, if those fundamentals are not met,
how
do they reach that point?
Yeah.
And then that obviously then affects their adulthood, etc.
And then they become what the world would say delinquent.
Yes.
Because they're not able to contribute to society. Yeah.
Yeah. We can go on forever.
Yeah, because again, with the attachment theory, people just see it as 0 to 2, even sometimes 0 to 6,
yeah.
I would say. But it goes beyond that, because the attachments that they have at home,
mm-hmm.
that influence attachments they have with
yep.
other members of society.
Yeah, so, of course. And just then it goes on to behaviour
yep.
and things like that. But then
conduct
obviously,
disorder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then school obviously then is the next step.
Yeah.
And 0 to 7 is like when we're looking at brain development, it's a time where your mind and your brain develops the most and is most flexible. It's the sponge at that point.
Yeah.
So anything that happens during that time forms your values,
yeah.
your morals and values, your beliefs, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes those things can be so hard to break, actually impact on your brain development. Because when we're looking at actually brain development, your brain doesn't develop until you're 25.
No. But then those neurons, those connections,
yeah.
those connections are actually being made.
Yeah.
So what I say to parents is, you know, you read into your child something is being connected.
Of course.
The moment
course.
You shout at a child for a small thing,
yeah.
the moment your child experiences aggression, something
yeah.
is being connected
yeah.
that shows that child this is the norm.
Yeah, this is how you behave
yeah,
in a circumstance.
Yeah, when you do a physical, when you're doing sensory
yeah.
play, something is
yeah.
being connected with touch.
Yeah.
So that 0 to 7 is so important
key.
For brain development.
So key.
Yeah.
And I think that people actually underestimate that.
Yeah.
As in, children don't know anything.
Yeah.
Oh, they don't see anything. But
yeah.
actually, we learn so much better visually
yep.
than we even do audibly.
Mm-hmm.
So even down to what you're seeing alone can actually form your reality,
yeah.
form your norms, but in your subconscious.
Yeah.
And then when it plays out...
But we do know those things,
mm-hmm.
not able to go deep into Freud, but
yeah.
those things are suppressed or even repressed.
Yeah.
And something... That's why sometimes things can happen in childhood.
Yeah.
Where the child is not really aware of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then something happens in their mid-teens and that thing just comes.
Yeah.
And they act it out.
Of course.
I know with children,
yeah.
instead of talking, they act it out. And everyone's like, why are they so sexualized? Why are they so this? Why are they so that? Because something has been...
Yes.
Something has
been triggered.
Pushed in
yeah.
their
mm-hmm.
unconscious for them
yeah.
to be able to function in life. And what's happened to them recently is just...
Yeah, brought it up to the forefront. And
up.
So it's just a plant, a seed, isn't
yeah.
it? And now it's unfortunately growing.
Yeah.
And to the point where it can manifest.
Yeah.
You know?
It's so interesting. So what external factors affect a child's health?
You
so
know,
we've got here housing, parenting, it could be anything.
Yeah. And so when I look at that, I really look at parenting again, because the caregiver, the family home, again, like we said, is the fundamental. When I look at parenting, I think automatically, Ghanaian, I think culture.
Yeah.
Straight away.
Culture does affect a child's
health. Of course. And then you have the nature versus nurture argument. But when we're looking at culture, and as well, if you don't live in the culture in which you're raised by,
yeah.
you have that
conflict.
Fight
yeah.
and the conflict going on. But essentially, I think culture essentially can influence on a child's health, just based on maybe, let's say, morals and values, but also expectations and how maybe one might view themselves in society and where they feel like they need to achieve or where they need to get to, rather than actually versus, should I say, the needs of the young person,
yeah.
the child. Because when we're looking at, we can see now how a lot of young people are being diagnosed with neurodiversity, for example, or they are neurodivergent, should I say, versus that impact, yeah, that you have there versus culture can be so detrimental to a young person's development in itself, but also self-fulfilling prophecy, self-esteem, etc. Because they are presenting in one way based on, because it's not a deformity, guys, it's just a difference. Difference is the key. So it causes a difference, and versus, should I say, their parents' cultural expectations and norms, that clash can actually impact on a child's health, because then they now can be stressed, they can be in, have a low mood. Children can be depressed. They
Children can be depressed. Yeah.
And so therefore that affects their health. And when you're looking at how mental health presents itself, just down to, you know, then having illnesses, for example, you can have a gastro illness just because of the stress that you're experiencing as a young person. Sleepless nights, which of course will impact on their growth and development.
And even how, I think when we talk about culturally or even society-wise, even how a parent reacts to that.
Yeah.
Based on their upbringing, based on, oh, because when I was growing up and I had a tummy ache, then my mum would just give me something and, you know, just oh, it's okay, without actually looking into what's going on.
Which and is looking at the symptoms.
Yeah, looking at the symptoms, which is why sometimes when we hear stories of women who didn't know they had certain conditions until they were going to the GP themselves, but they're always having painful periods.
For example.
They're always having painful periods, but everybody was just like, oh, okay.
And as well, if the parent, for example, has also experienced this painful periods, etc., and the symptom, and to them, and I say this because to them they think it's normal, they wouldn't encourage their child to go and seek medical help or even do that for the child. Because when we're looking at ages, under 16, essentially the parent does have the responsibility to support the child to do that. And if they don't believe that and their cultural beliefs are pushing against that, then that child is never going to get that support and never supported in the educational system to even, for example, attend school. You know, statistics, I think it's the Department of Education, even says one day of missing school sets your child back. Just one day. So think of a young girl that has period pains, has cramps, even if they're still attending because their parents making them go, how much are they focusing? How much are they taking in? And so therefore that is impacting on their attainment. Then they will feel behind. And then you have a whole plethora of things that come after that. You know, so I think...
And it's so funny because in all of this, the pain is still there.
This exactly.
The pain, the undiagnosed, undiagnosed pain is...
Essentially, it's still there.
Yeah,
you know?
It's still there.
And so I would say that when I'm looking at parenting, culture plays a huge impact. But also, it can be positive. That's not to say, let's not only look at the negative. Yeah. And I say that when I feel like, because obviously we are the diaspora and we live in the UK right now, London. I would say that, you know, those that live here, are born here, are more in tune with certain things. And they are more open, let's say, to diagnoses, also support, as well. And I say support because, you know, in certain cultures, oh, we don't tell our family business outside, or we don't express ourselves to other people. But if you don't do that, then you don't have that knowledge, and that's ignorance. So ignorance can be painful. It can, you can pay a huge price for that, you know. But I like that now, you know, social media, etc., although it has its pros and cons, the education is out there, and young people are able to say, okay, maybe I do have that, and I do have this, and I can actually go forward and actually seek medical help myself, of course, if you're 13 and competent.
I think as well, going back to the positives, I think one thing that culture does do is that some cultures, because of the importance around having a child, not raising a child sometimes, having a child is, and how it's seen as an inheritance. If a child is sick in that culture, in that community, it is a big
thing,
it is a big thing, you know, because children are
precious.
Precious.
They're the generation to come, isn't it?
So that's a positive as well.
Legacy, etc.
Which can affect a child's health positively when it comes to their children.
They don't play.
Yeah.
They don't play.
They don't play. At if, all. If you're telling them they need to get this injection, they're going to get the injection. They're not going to think about if, you know, if it's this, if it's that. So that's a positive
which
as
immunizations
well.
Is a interesting topic. Which I won't go into.
So we've spoken about, we've lightly touched on it, but what can parents do to advocate for their children health-wise? And let's do it in two parts. Advocate in front of the healthcare professional, but also by their life, by their morals as well.
I love that you said that because I was actually going to touch on that. You know, when people think about advocacy, they think, oh, power to the people, justice, I'm going to fight for you. But actually, being a role model in itself is being an advocate. Teaching your child or young person essentially is being an advocate, essentially, because you're preparing them for life, things to eat, personal hygiene, all of these things, just how to be a good person, a nice person, in fact, you know, all of these things contribute. So if we're looking at it from being a parent, I would say just how the family dynamic is set up, how the household is set up, in terms of just communication. Something as simple as communication, how you speak to, I don't know, your partner, your husband, your kids in the house, actually is being an advocate for your child, because essentially you're showing them, this is how I can communicate, no matter the feeling, that however I'm feeling, angry, sad, happy, etc. So I think that in itself is being an advocate, but teaching them the ways of life. So the basic fundamentals, when we're looking at life, it's safety, nutrition, support, love, etc. So you would want to have to be an example in that sense. But when I'm looking at it in a health perspective, I would say, like we said, taking them to appointments, but also asking questions. And I feel like asking questions is so important, because just because someone's a professional
doesn't mean you can ask questions.
Listen, I could go somewhere, and because you think I'm honest, I could tell you anything. If you believe it, that's crazy to me. I feel like, obviously, there are things that are, you know, the basics. But if I'm literally giving you advice or giving you treatment, etc., you need to be able to ask what this means. What is it? Clarify. Have that conversation.
So, when clarifying, are you saying that parents should be able to ask, okay, so what does this mean?
What does it mean?
What does this
what
mean?
What does it look like?
Okay, my child has to have this prescription for 3 months. Can you tell me why? Okay, if we stop at 1 month. What happens?
All of these things. And is it necessary for that length of time? What is the impact if I do stop, if I start and I do stop, or I'm reducing, etc.? Because I think about it, like, when parents advocate for their children that are on ADHD medication, for example, it's very important to actually find out, what are the implications if I was to start this medication and then stop? Because maybe the young person doesn't want to have it anymore. What are the withdrawals? All of these sorts of things. This goes for any type of care that you're having. You know, and I feel like ask those questions. But ask those questions if you genuinely also don't understand.
No,
if you actually
true.
Don't know. Because health literacy is, again, something that is so important in society. But again, when we're looking at poverty, that lack of health health literacy as well is what is impacting on the poor outcomes for children and young people, essentially. So ask those questions. There's services there. If you need an interpreter, if you need someone to support you, all
those
these
services
things,
are there. And the thing about it is, I think certain communities use it more than others. It's only every so often that there'll be an emergency, and then I'm sure you've had experience where you see email, oh, is there any Yoruba speaking person here? Is there any tree speaking person here? And it's like, but that person had the opportunity to actually get a paid interpreter.
Exactly.
That would have their time to sit.
Exactly. But I think that as well, it comes down to the perceived level of English. I think that health professionals, I will say maybe we're a little bit guilty for that, is that we only consider interpreter when someone has zero English or 10%, 15%. But actually, having 80% English doesn't mean that you actually understand what's happening in this environment here.
And how do you give your child, how do you give your child that care when you leave that? When you are discharged, if you actually didn't understand what the nurse said.
Exactly. I think that that's very important as well. But again, we, health professionals need to take a cultural aware, like, should be culturally aware and actually consider these factors when approaching families as well. When you're looking at families that are also coming back for the same, maybe illnesses or the same concerns, I do feel like it's the health professional's responsibility in that moment to look at the whole picture holistically and actually confirm, do they even understand what's happening here? You know, and I feel like sometimes being stretched, not as an excuse, but being stretched, because I just feel like even my experience when I go to the GP, I'll never forget, I asked for two things. So I think I maybe asked for my height and weight, and I asked for my blood pressure. She told me I actually can only do one. What? I haven't got time to do both. What?
I was late 5 minutes on Monday, and they sent me back.
5 minutes. But
I waited 3 weeks for that appointment.
But I promise you that if you had gone there on time, you would have been waiting X amount of time anyway. 5 minutes, and you didn't. Anyway, I'm not advocating for
lateness. I know.
But I'm not even advocating for madness. But 5 minutes,
I'm
you managed.
That. So going back to parents and advocating for their children, health-wise. So what you're saying is speaking up,
speaking
answering
up.
Questions. No question is
a stupid question.
And this goes for mental health. This goes for health. This goes for assessments, neurodiversity assessments. Because I think there is a lot of fear around that.
I think the only thing, the fear comes to actually accepting that your child might be neurodivergent.
That's what I think it is.
Yeah.
That's what I think it is. Yeah. And I think, that's exactly what it is.
Religion too.
I think it's religion, but I also think it's actually a social norm and a cultural thing we're battling with it.
Yeah.
Because one thing I mentioned to somebody last week was that when we're speaking about this, what parents need to realise is that, no one is... The label doesn't come from anywhere.
Yeah.
Especially at a certain young age.
Yeah.
If there are glimmers and the concern has been shared.
Yeah.
And even if you are a person of faith.
Yeah.
Go home and observe.
Yeah.
What's going on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And sometimes you will see that there are glimmers. And you can take those glimmers and say, okay, what strategies I can implement at home with the help of the professional.
This is
it. But for you to see... it play out in your face and then to ignore, that's not advocating for
that's
your child.
That's not advocating for your
child. If it was a physical illness, would you do the same thing? Would you ignore because, it can't be my child?
Yeah.
When blatantly you can see that your child's nose is bleeding every day or your child has bruises or...
Yeah.
Would exactly. You
I like
it?
That comparison,
Would you actually ignore it? Or would you go and advocate and speak for your child?
Yeah,
and
it's
the
true.
Thing is, just like physical... And I don't even want to call it an illness, so I'm just comparing it.
Yeah.
Just like things that happen physically, if you do not treat it, sometimes it doesn't go away.
It doesn't go away.
There are only a few things that actually go away.
Yeah.
And the things like neurodiversity, you not being able or you not wanted to advocate because of your feelings behind it, then that child grows into an adult now that was neglected.
Essentially.
Was neglected. Essentially. And could have had early intervention.
Exactly. And I feel like, especially where we know the statistics shows that girls are fantastic at masking.
Yes, fantastic.
It would be the caregiver, it would be the parent to be able to identify that because they are with them all the time.
Yeah.
So they would be the only ones, I would even say, that would be able to identify maybe certain behaviours that are very, very like mild, essentially.
That can be observed.
Yeah. And in that, when you're going to the GP, pediatrician, etc., you would then be the advocate to say that I know that maybe she or him is he or she is not maybe hitting the threshold to say that, yes, they do have this. But this is what I've noticed. And this is what I've noticed. And maybe it shows in other areas because we know that it doesn't all present the same.
It doesn't. And the thing about sometimes is that because you spoke about repeated sickness at times, sometimes we know things can present physically and it becomes repetitive and it's like, well, why does this always happen?
Yeah, exactly.
Why are you the one to always fall and bang your head?
Yeah.
What happens before that?
Exactly.
Are you dysregulated?
Yeah.
Do you become overwhelmed?
Yeah.
And you use that unconsciously
What are the patterns?
What are the patterns? But then because it's something physical, we're just presented with the physical and we have to deal with it because it's obviously
not looking at
the child
roots.
Is banging their head, we don't want them to have a huge injury.
So essentially it's only managed from that point of view rather than actually looking at the root cause. And I think that's very common, to be honest.
Yeah, it is.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, it's extremely interesting. When it comes to modelling, I'm even thinking about specific things, whereas, if you come from a family where high blood pressure is in the family, and that doesn't mean that you and your child would be a partaker of that.
Uh-huh.
But then even putting things out there where, putting some psychoeducation in the home about red meat, about not eating too much salt, actually not cooking with too much salt. Because there's one thing about having the information.
Yeah, and then applying
it. That you see on your GP wall that a nurse can give you, but it's actually doing the work at home that your children can actually have a positive.
But then I'll go back to say that it all comes down to when you're even looking at the health belief model, for example, the perceived severity. Sometimes people genuinely don't believe something, even if it's around them, until it happens to them where they drop down. And even that, I say that sometimes that's not enough?
No, it's not.
Because our habits, again, we're going all the way back to the fundamentals of our upbringing, 0 to 7. Mm. If they've seen, for example, let's say they've grown up in a home, they've seen a parent smoke all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah? They then pick up smoking eventually, and then, I don't know, they have a stroke. Yeah. Whatever, that is still in their core, core memory, their core morals and values.
Mm-hmm. So it's actually been implemented.
Breaking that habit, even though there is now affecting their health greatly, actually they think maybe it wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
So that perceived severity, I think, really impacts. So parents might have a diagnosis, but do they think, this could affect my child in long term or etc.? So again, I think that perception really matters.
That's so interesting.
And yeah, it comes down to the, because they also, I think that people also, like, I don't know, say, like, use age as a factor as well. So they think that, oh, maybe it's not my, especially if they like their traditional food. Yeah. No one ain't going to stop them from eating it, you know. So, you know, I think all those factors, actually, they think, will people actually look at their child and think, oh, you need to start early?
No, I think it's, it's an intentional thought.
Yeah.
That not everybody gets to.
And I don't think that people do,
I think we take it for, I think all of us have habits where we take for granted that we think,
100%.
If and when you're raising children, am I advocating for their health in that? Which is actually an interesting point in itself, that what you do as an adult, taking the child to the GP, making sure they go for all their checkups.
That's fantastic. By the home.
In room and when they're birth, but actually what you actually do. So we're speaking about things like smoking. We're speaking about things like even eating. Cooking. Health. Going on walks, fitness. If we are not doing that, are we actually advocating for our children?
And also in some families, you know, the parents don't even eat together. Number one.
So
number
two. So how does your child learn actually food patterns? What to eat first? If they don't observe that, I actually have to eat my protein first. You know, some of us, we learn that you have to eat your rice first before you eat your protein.
And then you're possibly,
and it's then only now, as a woman in my 30s, that they're telling me that, actually, but if you actually ate your food this way,
you'd be full.
You wouldn't, you wouldn't have the issues that you say that you're experiencing.
It's such a, it's so important as well. And this whole, eat your carbs first, then your protein. Like the protein is as if it's like a treat. And then
the protein is what keeps your body going. That's the medicine, not the carbs.
But then their, I think their notion, or, and I say their because I'm coming from the culture that I'm speaking on, but it's just, they just want a child to be full, and if they look big, if then they're healthy.
No, but, and, but again, that's understanding, and we know where that comes from. We know where that comes
from. If you got money, you can afford, so.
We know where that comes from. We know where that comes from, and till today, like, I don't even really want to go into it, but there's this TikTok challenge where people are packing lunchbox for their kids in Nigeria. You know, sometimes in that side of the world, when a trend comes, until there's fights, until there's insults, until it lands on the pulpit, they don't stop. But you see adults' attitude towards mothers waking up early to make their children slice plantain, beans. They're like, oh, this is too much. Oh, this is, and those are learned. Those are learned behaviors.
That, of course.
That this type of food is for adults. This type of food is too much. But the food that these parents are packing are nutritious.
Just smaller foods. Portions.
It's not Indomie and.
But
you know,
is that, no? And it comes to as well. You know, a child can only have one meat.
Yeah.
The parent, the dad is sitting at the top. If they're even eating together, the dad is sitting there. There's 5-6 meats, and the child has got some small.
One's protein. It's funny. No, the thing is, it's funny, but then these are actually, it's pertaining to health.
Yeah, it's people's reality.
It's pertaining to health.
Like, I'm not going to lie, guys, I had to eat my carbs first, then I got my protein, then I got a drink after.
But then we know things like protein is very, very, and important, as you grow, you understand. So I guess that is kind of modern. It's like changing the patterns that you were taught because of different reasons. Now you're on a new season. Now that you are a parent, how are you teaching your children? You know, it's so interesting to me when parents say, when we talk about vegetables and things, and I know it can be difficult, but does your child see you eat, you know, broccoli, sugar snaps?
You know what? This is something that I know that I'm going to deal with when I become a parent, because I'm such a picky eater.
Okay, you're one of them.
The palate is so small.
Really?
But I know that when I become a parent, I'm going to have to sit on that table. Nice. And I'm going to have to eat it. I hope I'm just like... Because I want them to,
you want them to be. Yeah.
So, and I think that that's something that I'm willing to do it, but everybody has to be willing to do those things, change those patterns, and actually be open to it. Think about even the times that you're eating, all of these factors contributing. Sleep is so important, even for adults.
Yeah. And that's one thing that I don't like. My friends know when adults boast, oh, you know, like, I don't sleep 12 hours a day. You know, I keep on going. What is sleep?
Not a good thing.
In my head, I'm like,
it's not
because if I don't, I know what my body does.
Yeah.
So you guys are the hard workers. You guys are the most.
Not
guys
for me.
Are the ones. Yeah. Because again, health.
Exactly.
Sometimes we say these things around young children, and then now they say, oh, you know, I don't sleep. I'm always on my phone. I can't.
Yeah.
It's affecting their health.
Of course, it's affecting
and their
health.
Mental health.
Like holistically, sleep is so underrated.
Mm-hmm.
Is what I would say.
I really love how we touched on that question.
Yeah.
So, sexual health. I want us to touch on sexual health. How, as a nurse, how, and this is so, I've spoken about it on the Parent Ambassador platform on Instagram, and I've had conversations with parents about it. Sexual health, how do we touch on sexual health with our children? With sexual health, it's not only about sex.
Exactly.
But about your body, your autonomy.
Consent.
Communication.
Have an understanding.
Hygiene.
Knowing that you have a right.
Yes.
All of these things. So it's so great, but their whole thing is, just don't have sex and don't get pregnant.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the whole thing. I think how you have to approach it as a parent, I think I would start off by saying, educate yourself.
Yes.
And that's the first step. So when we're actually educating ourselves, we're looking at what is sexual health?
Yeah.
You know, sexual health is the same as physical health. It's something that essentially we need it as part of our health. So looking at what does that look like and actually breaking it down.
Yeah.
Yes, sex is an act, but the health of it.
Sexual organs. Yeah.
Exactly. So actually knowing the functions, I would say. Because, you know, a lot of them would be, or a lot of adults, you could show them like a diagram, I don't know, of the vagina. They wouldn't know.
They wouldn't know.
Well, not the vagina, but the female reproductive system.
They wouldn't know.
And they wouldn't know what
honestly,
different things are, you know. So I would say actually educate yourself on what sex is and the health of it. So we're looking at consent and the law as well.
The law, which we're going to touch on,
Consent and the law, but also sexual transmitted diseases. A lot of people don't know what that is.
Yeah.
Contraception.
Yeah.
All of those factors. And actually educate yourself on where your young person can get support from, where your child can get support from. But I would say when it comes to approaching the question, again, you have to be confident as a parent, but also know that you are the only one that can give them the best advice to support them in terms of keeping them safe.
Yeah.
You know, it's a fundamental right to be safe.
Yeah.
And you as a parent, as a caregiver, have to be able to provide that information. You don't want them to hear it from outside.
And I think as well, there's some think about if you are the one, because the fact is every family has values, different values. So if I come from a home where I do not want, because of the values I've instilled into my children, I don't want them to think that, you know, casual sex or take sex casually, then if I have that belief, I have to be the one to teach my children about it.
Exactly.
Because school are going to teach about contraception and etc. for when you do, this is what you do. But then in our home, we may teach our children differently.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean they should be blinded by what sex
exactly.
is, because we don't want them to
engage.
We don't want them to engage in it, which is okay.
Yeah, and you can have that conversation. The thing is, I feel like you're never going to be able to be with your child 24/7 or to be able to control what they do.
And the thing is with sex, again, going into the psychology and therapeutic side is, adolescents do explore.
Yes.
Even if they don't explore physically, they explore in their minds.
Yes. And that's where it starts anyway. Everything starts in your mind.
It starts in your mind.
Yeah.
There is, your hormones are playing around.
They exist.
They exist. The urges exist.
They exist.
So when you're raising an adolescent, and especially when you don't agree with what's going on in society, and you don't agree with how the school are teaching in a way of, oh, everyone has sex, so here's a condom.
Yeah.
You have to be honest with yourself and know that, okay, they're coming to this age. Mm-hmm. Be honest with yourself in your mind where you were at that time.
You've been there.
Do you want your child to have the same experience as you, or are you happy with how you were taught about sex and what sex is, how sex is? And how do you relay that to your child to keep them safe?
Exactly. But then I think this comes to positive and healthy parental relationships in the first place. You should already have been building a positive relationship with your child that you can approach them, create that safe space, bring up the topic, touch on it in pieces if you need to, in sections, and then actually visit that as you go along and actually give them the opportunity to ask you questions and have an understanding of what it maybe looks like to you, or what how you perceive it for a young person. And into adulthood as well, you're allowed to learn and have that development at that time to know that when I do become an adult, I'm looking at it that way.
So going into consent,
it's
such a tricky, touchy subject. But what are some of the laws? What are some of the facts that are laws that we... Some parents watching this, some people watching this may not agree, or some may agree, but what are the laws? Because there is so much about this thing about what children can disclose to their parents and what can be disclosed to healthcare professionals legally that they don't have to tell parents.
Yes. So I thought that this one, I definitely said I'm going to make notes on this one.
Please.
So essentially, when you're looking at UK laws, I personally broke it down into a few sections.
Okay.
So, first of all, I think we'll start with age of consent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So essentially, generally speaking, children under 16, mm-hmm. yeah, parents are, okay, let's say parents that have parental responsibility.
Okay.
And parental responsibility.
That's important.
Yeah, parental responsibility, obviously, firstly, the mother, full stop. And it would be the father if they're on a birth certificate
okay.
and if they are married at the time of birth.
Okay, so a father correct. That is not on that can't just come in and say, I want to see my child's records.
No, unfortunately. Okay. Unfortunately, it's not legal.
Okay.
Because just and they weren't married at the time.
Okay.
No, the mum didn't put the name down. No, you do not have parental responsibility.
Okay.
That stays with the mother mm-hmm. completely, yeah? So when we're looking at generally, so any child that is under 16, you would assume, or the law assumes that the parent that has parental responsibility would be the one that's consenting to the health for the child,
mm-hmm.
yeah? But then obviously you then go on to different dynamics, yeah? So we can look at Gillett competency. And essentially that is for children that are under 16, yeah, mm-hmm. that health professionals can assess the child
okay.
and find out whether they're Gillett competent. And Gillett competent means that they have the maturity
okay.
and the understanding to make their own decisions.
At under 16?
Yeah, so okay. it would be from about 13 to 16,
okay.
yeah. No, your response is killing me. You said, okay. so they have the maturity and the understanding to make their own decisions about their health. So this mm-hmm. is only based on health, yeah,
okay.
competency, yeah. And if a child is deemed competent, they can actually refuse for their parents to have access to their health records.
Okay, so which is why it's important for parents to advocate from the home
yeah,
and have these conversations
exactly.
from the home if you want to be involved
exactly.
in your child's...
Yeah. But don't get me wrong, the role of the health professional still is to encourage.
Protect. Yeah, okay. Oh.
It's actually encourage
okay.
them to
because
speak to their
parents.
Because
some people would feel like it's not that's not
no,
the
no,
professionals.
No, 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 no.
You know, if a 13-year-old yeah. comes to me and I think they're
yeah.
mature, I'm
yeah.
going to tell them, you don't have to tell your
no,
mom.
No, 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 no. I
okay.
always encourage that.
Okay.
I also encourage that. And it is the role of the health professional to encourage it.
Okay.
Because essentially, the parents still have parental responsibility of that child.
Yes.
So it's very important for them to be involved, to be able to support them
mm-hmm.
to the maximum that they can.
Yeah.
So we do encourage it. Whether the child wants to or not, we can consider different factors
okay.
in that sense. It's like when you're doing a safeguarding referral for
yeah.
a child, you're supposed to inform the parent,
yeah,
but obviously there are factors in which you may not
that
inform
contradict
the parent.
To the safeguarding issue.
Exactly,
yeah.
in that sense. But then when we're even looking at like health records and stuff like that, parents usually do also have the right up to 16. But again, a 13-year-old, like I said, can say no
okay.
to that.
Mm.
13, 14, 15, if they are Gillett competent.
But
yeah?
if an under 16-year-old
mm-hmm.
was to go into a GP
yeah.
about a certain issue and
yeah.
they said, I don't want my parents to have access to this conversation
yeah.
or this record,
yeah.
would that have... practitioner asks why or
yeah I
or they just have to do that assessment and see
they would have to do the assessment they would ask why I
okay.
don't see why they would not ask why but also if we're looking at the best interest of the child though
mm.
yeah and it's like they're at harm or they're at risk
yeah
then essentially that can override that the best
yeah.
interest of the child
yeah.
and that would be in terms of sharing information to professionals as well so when I was a school nurse I would kind of have the conversation
mm.
in the beginning where oh hi
yeah.
my name is XYZ welcome to today's clinic anything we talk about today is confidential
yeah.
however if there is anything that pertains to your safety
mm-hmm.
health or the safety and health of someone else then I will be reporting it
mm-hmm.
okay and then in the appointment as I'm doing my assessment etc let's say there's something I want to ask a parent about I ask for consent for that
yeah
I say to them, okay I'm going to say to your parent XYZ and there's different sections so when I do like a health assessment we're looking at various things we're looking at diet nutrition
okay.
sleep
again the foundation
sexual health height weight measurement vision and hearing all of those sorts of things and it might get to I don't know they haven't been to the opticians I will still say I'm going to call your mum and tell her that
okay.
you need to go to the optician
mm-hmm.
but then when we're looking at I think the tricky part always is the sexual health part
yeah
they don't
the
actually
part.
Mind you telling
anything
them about
else.
Anything else
yeah but that is the tricky
that
one
is the tricky
that is
part.
The tricky one
and so in that moment as a health professional I need to then identify whether they are actually this sounds crazy because sometimes it can go against your morals and values but anyway
no, yeah
but then mm. you have to determine in that moment let's say a 14-year-old tells me that they're having sex
mm.
in that moment I need to find out who they're having sex with
yeah.
how old is that person is it consensual do you have an understanding of what you're doing
but and then those are all me knowing you, those are all part of your morals and values though, those questions.
Yeah, yeah. But then I feel like as a professional then, like I'm gonna keep it real. Sometimes when I see these girls, I'm like, but you're 14. I wanna say
boys.
To them,
and the and boys.
But I wanna tell them, don't do it.
Yeah, no, same, same.
Like, don't do it.
Sometimes
like,
sometimes I just have a word at the tip of my mouth.
I'm like, you know what? Yeah. One thing I struggle with is, you know, they come in, and I'm not saying that it's not true. I'm not saying that, oh, I'm so in love. I'm going to marry this girl.
It's not true.
Eh? Life hasn't come yet for you.
And then that child, someone would say they're mature enough to share information about decisions they're making about something that's happened.
According to Gilly competence.
Yeah. So it's a tricky one.
Yeah.
So maybe we would say that that is why it's important for parents to start the advocacy from
100%. 100%.
Yeah.
You know, so we're looking at best interest as well, but then we're also looking at data protection as well, GDPR, etc.
Yeah, the formalities.
Yeah. So basically, all professionals must ensure that they have a valid basis for sharing information.
Yeah.
You know, so if, again, valid, sometimes you might have a gut instinct as a professional.
Professional gut instinct is...
So you have professional curiosity.
Don't kill it, professionals. Don't kill your gut instinct.
But if you don't have that concrete evidence...
You have to wait for things to play out.
But don't worry, as professionals, there's other avenues that we go by. Mm. You know, had a young person, doing an assessment, they were 12. She didn't look 12, she was quite mature. Mm. I felt like she was sexually active. I didn't have no proof. When I asked her, she said no.
But you
what can I do there? So as a professional, what you would do is that in the best interest of the child, you'll speak to other professionals that have worked with the young person.
So you'll have your supervision, your case discussions.
Have a team around a child meeting. And then
you're
you can
on the YDS now.
Yeah. So kind of have those conversations and actually find out maybe also the parents' perspective. What are their concerns? Mm-hmm. Is how I approach it. I will never say, oh, I feel X, Y, Z.
No.
But I'll say, do you have any concerns for your child?
Yeah.
And what do those concerns look like?
Okay.
9 times out of 10, the parents are not going to have no concerns in terms
of
sexual
health.
Yeah,
because their way
and also
present.
Maybe they have other kids, things are happening, you know, all these factors. So unfortunately, but fortunately, we don't completely neglect the parents. That's not the aim, by the way.
That's not the aim, which is important for people to hear, because I think people think that the aim is to exclude parents.
No,
but sometimes some of these laws that come out are actually to protect children because of what's happened in the past.
Exactly.
Where things like abuse has been so innate in families and so covered that children don't have an outlet.
Yeah, exactly.
Children are coming and saying, you know, males are saying something happened to them. Women are, girls are presented with pregnancies, you know.
And I like
actually
you touch,
they come from...
I like that you touch on males as well, because unfortunately in our society it's perceived that men can... Things like that can't happen to boys, men, etc. So actually having that safe space and with a professional does encourage that.
Mm.
And yes, I just want to say again, we're not against the parents. We're really not against the parents.
Thank you
I always
so much.
Advocate for my young people.
Parents.
Like, why can you speak to your mum about this?
Same.
And because one of my questions is like, when you feel happy or sad, like who do you speak to?
Yes.
Who can you go to?
Oh, that's
who do you confide in?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
As a professional
who do you speak to?
Yeah.
Some of them will say their friends. I'll be like, why not your mum? Why not your dad? Why not this? Like,
planting
why not an adult? Like,
planting that seed.
Oh, but I had a young person that said, I can speak to my mum about anything, but my mum is judgmental.
Oh.
But her mum has, I don't know how she's done it, created some kind of safe space where she can still say, but I don't
but
know.
But then her mum will tell her the truth. So maybe she's now saying it
it's
as judgmental. It's
judgmental. Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, so there are very, I will say there are very few young people that tell me they can speak to their parents.
Yeah.
Very
interesting.
Few.
Parents, please have the conversations at home.
Yeah.
That's the beginning of advocacy. It's
yeah.
not when you have to go to the doctor or when you're on the ward and now you're talking to the nurse.
Yeah, literally, very few. And they will say, I'll speak to my friends about it, or maybe my older cousin or things like that. But it's very few
that
young
can speak
people
to
that...
their children, their parents.
Yeah, which is a shame.
It is a shame. Thank you so, so much. This has been such a good conversation. But my last conversation is, and it's important because you're not on a ward anymore.
No.
You're not in a school. You are in...
Youth Justice System, now service.
So what do nurses... So what would a nurse be doing in a... Youth Justice Service. Just give us a quick
synopsis. So essentially it's still kind of somewhat a public health role.
Okay.
So essentially as part of their court order, they have to see me as a health professional to be able to identify any health needs. We're still promoting health promotion, and also like unfortunately at that point the early intervention has sort of maybe missed the boat.
Go on, they haven't even engaged. I'm sorry. There's someone that's worked for three families from some of them don't even engage until that
you know,
court order.
So the early intervention is late. However, it's still that moment to step in and say, do you know what? You still have a chance to do better. You still have a chance to turn your life around. And this is by empowering them with their health to know that they can actually advocate for themselves. Mm. They can actually still contribute to society. Yeah. And essentially, like we touched on before, if your health is not 100%, then you can't essentially be that citizen and contribute back to society. So essentially, yeah, my role is to support the team while they're YJS anyway, to encourage rehabilitation back into society. Okay. And yeah,
that's an amazing role. Yeah, wish you so
prevent crime. Wow.
Yeah, actually, ask Nurse, what's next?
What's next? I don't know what's next, but watch this space.
Okay, then watch this space. Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Thank you. Hello, welcome to the Parent Advice Hub. My name is Lisa Ogbede. Please do subscribe and follow us on Instagram at The Parent Advice Hub. You can also check us out online at www.theparentadvicehub.com. Thank you.